find itself with two registration systems or two different mail-in deadlines for absentee ballots, all depending on the particular state constitutional issues that the state court rules on. This makes less than no sense as a matter of separation of powers. It doesn't make any sense as a matter even of imagining what a legislature might have intended when it passes a single law governing both state and federal elections. So it could cause enormous chaos. It also opens the door to a kind of mischief, or mischief is an understatement. It gives the state legislatures the power to do things that they wouldn't otherwise be able to do. And so they could pass laws that govern just federal elections that are extremely problematic from the perspective of democracy. They could draw, for example, as in North Carolina, incredibly gerrymandered congressional districts. They could even potentially create systems in which a state legislature gets to resolve any disputes over election results in federal elections, which would include presidential elections. And we could imagine what that might look like down the road. It could be extremely dangerous. Much of that, if not all of it, would be unconstitutional under many, if not all, state constitutions. But under the ISLT, that wouldn't matter.
Finally, we just have 30 seconds. How does this relate to the Voting Rights Act?
Well, they're both the Voting Rights Act and the ISLT, or the movement against the ISLT, are ways of trying to protect voting, protect the power of the people to choose their own representatives. And in those cases, as in others, the Supreme Court, the majority, continues to cut back on protections for voting and protections for democracy. It's extremely dangerous.
And again, ISLT stands for something you'll be hearing much more of with this court, the independent state legislature theory. And we want to thank Professor Carolyn Shapiro, professor of law and director of the Institute on the Supreme Court of the United States at Chicago Kent College of Law at the Illinois Institute of Technology. We'll link to your piece in the Washington Post, A New Supreme Court Case Threatens Another Body Blow to Our Democracy. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kabu.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KABU, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please visit our website at kabu.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 42nd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 15th through Sunday, July 17th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. Jazz, blues, soul, and Latin musicians will rock the park for 3 days. Tony Coleman, Eddie Martinez, Outer Orbit, and Greater Kind are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 42nd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 15th through Sunday, July 17th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Smooth mind, floating like a butterfly, new set of float, sung like a lullaby, brace yourself.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Highland Park shooter got guns despite a history of violence and threats. A measure to limit legislative walkouts makes November ballot in Oregon. And, in international news, Great Britain's Prime Minister takes heavy criticism. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, July 6th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. The man charged with killing seven people at an Independence Day parade in Highland Park, Illinois, legally bought the high-powered rifle used in the shooting, as well as four other weapons. The purchases were made despite the fact the man repeatedly demonstrated an inclination toward violence. Robert E. Cremo III was charged with seven counts of murder. Prosecutors plan to seek dozens more charges, which may include attempted murder and aggravated battery. If convicted, Cremo faces life without parole. Cremo made his first court appearance today and was ordered held without bail. More than three dozen other people were wounded in the attack, which the suspect had allegedly been planning for several weeks. The assault came fewer than 3 years after police went to Cremo's home following a call from a family member who said he was threatening to kill everyone there. Police confiscated 16 knives, a dagger, and a sword, but said there was no sign he had any firearms at the time. That same year, 2019, police also responded to a reported suicide attempt by the suspect. Cremo legally purchased the rifle used in the attack, one similar to an AR-15, in Illinois within the past year. He applied for a license in December of 2019, when he was 19. His father sponsored the application. State police said at the time, quote, there was insufficient basis to establish a clear and present danger, end quote, and the application was approved. In all, Cremo purchased five firearms, which were recovered by police officers at his father's home. Cremo's social media posts do not give any indication that he targeted victims by race, religion, or other protected status. At the July 4th parade, the shots were initially mistaken for fireworks before hundreds of attendees ran. The shooting occurred at a spot on the parade route where many residents had staked out prime viewing points earlier in the day. The gunman initially evaded capture, allegedly by dressing as a woman and blending into the fleeing crowd. A police officer pulled over 21-year-old Cremo north of the shooting scene several hours after police released his photograph. In 2013, Highland Park officials tried to ban semi-automatic weapons and large-capacity firearm magazines. A local doctor in the Illinois State Rifle Association challenged the stance, and the U.S. Supreme Court declined to hear the case in 2015. The restrictions remained in place. Under Illinois law, gun purchases can be denied to people convicted of felonies, those addicted to narcotics, or those deemed capable of harming themselves or others. Theoretically, the last provision could have stopped Cremo, who had attempted suicide, from getting a weapon. But under the law, the application of that provision must be decided by a court, board, commission, or other legal authority. Illinois also has a so-called red flag law, designed to stop potentially dangerous people, but it requires family members, relatives, roommates, or police to ask a judge to order firearms to be taken away. Cremo had posted dozens of videos and songs on social media, some violent. He had allegedly researched mass killings and had downloaded multiple photos depicting violent acts. Investigators have yet to identify a motive for the Independence Day murders. More details emerge on July 4th Highland Park shooting. Gun violence erupts across the entire United States, and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani is subpoenaed. With more on these stories, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We started shooting again, and we ran behind the building, and I put my son in a dumpster, and he sit there with his dog, and I went back to look for the rest of my family. I left him with someone there.
A father who witnessed the July 4th parade mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois, describes the horrific scene as he hid his son. The shooting left at least seven people dead and 30 injured. Law enforcement has released more details about suspected shooter Robert Cremo, including that he disguised himself as a woman. Lake County Major Crimes Task Force Officer Chris Cavelli.
We do believe Cremo pre-planned this attack for several weeks. He brought a high-powered rifle to this parade. He accessed the roof of a business via a fire escape ladder and began opening fire on the innocent Independence Day celebration goers.
Illinois Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth on watching videos of the shooting.
And let me tell you that the last time I heard a weapon with that capacity firing that rapidly on a 4th of July was Iraq. It was not the United States of America.
Gun violence spiked over Independence Day weekend, with shootings reported in nearly every U.S. state that killed at least 220 people and wounded more than 500, according to the Gun Violence Archive. Public outcry over the nation's epidemic of gun violence has increased. Here's LA Galaxy soccer player Sasha Kleshten on Tuesday refusing to talk about a recent game his team played, but instead addressed the shooting in Illinois.
I think we need to talk about gun control. You guys can write about the game if you want, but I don't really give a it's a sick, vicious cycle that keeps happening over and over, and we're doing nothing about it.
Some Republican lawmakers are pointing to religious and family values as a solution to the epidemic of mass shootings, in addition to their calls to harden schools and focus on mental health. At the White House Tuesday, Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre responded to questioning on what the Biden administration plans to do about abortion access in a post-Roe versus Wade world.
The president is going to do everything that he can from his legal authority to make sure that we're protecting women's freedoms and women's rights.
On Tuesday, a Fulton County, Georgia grand jury issued subpoenas on seven people, including Rudy Giuliani, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, and conservative lawyer John Eastman, as part of an investigation surrounding former President Donald Trump. I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
Attorneys began arguing a case that will affect the fate of the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrival program. Suzanne Potter has more on the story.
The fate of more than 600,000 so-called dreamers hangs in the balance as opening statements are heard today in a case that could make or break the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program. The Justice Department is appealing a decision last summer that declared DACA illegal. Now the three-judge panel of the Fifth Circuit in New Orleans will decide whether to uphold or reject that summary judgment or order a full trial. Attorney Nina Perales with the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund says the state of Texas, which sued to block DACA, should not have standing to sue because it cannot prove the state has been harmed.
Texas has not been able to point to any employers that Texas says hired a DACA recipient instead of a U.S. citizen. Texas was never able to identify a dollar of state money that went to a DACA recipient.
The state of Texas has argued that DACA takes jobs away from legal U.S. residents and that it costs the state money in the form of social services. Gabby Pacheco, an advocate with TheDream.us, says the average age of arrival for DACA participants is 7, and most have lived in the U.S. for more than 20 years.
99% of them have graduated from high school. More than 90% of them are working, including more than 340,000 workers deemed essential, including nurses, educators, and those who kept food on our tables during the pandemic.
Right now, current DACA participants are allowed to stay and renew their work permits, but no new applications are being processed. Congress has been unable to forge a consensus on immigration reform or a path to citizenship for Dreamers. Perales notes that the Biden administration is expected to release a new regulation related to DACA, possibly in August. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Groups want lawmakers to strongly consider the needs of Black women when making policy. Lily Bulkey has more.
As states ban abortion, with the overturning of Roe versus Wade, women's advocates in New York and beyond are raising awareness of the outsized impact these policies will have on Black women. And they're outlining a framework for economic and health justice moving forward. The Congressional Caucus on Black Women and Girls has created a legislative agenda for putting Black women at the center of these policy discussions to address their longstanding economic barriers. Asa Al-Tarafi with the group Liberation in a Generation co-chaired the working group that put together the report. They say dismantling every structure of oppression is necessary to create collective economic prosperity and to strengthen democracy.
It is futile to singularly focus on just closing racial gaps, whether it's wealth or health or housing or education, unless they are also willing to uproot and dismantle the primary causes of those inequities in the first place.
The report relies on the intersectional Black Women Best framework coined by the first Black woman to serve as chief economist in the Department of Labor, Janelle Jones. Al-Tarifi says it builds on a rich history of Black women's feminist scholarship and includes ties to disability reproductive and economic justice. Along with centering Black women, Al-Tarifi says it's important to follow their leadership on these issues that have affected them disproportionately. They add, in the post-Roe landscape, advocates will be looking to the networks of abortion care that have been built by Black women over time.
Black women have, in the face of such organized abandonment, both historically and presently, created their own systems, networks of care and communal support to meet each other's needs at a time and in places where the state was failing to do so.
The report points to such policies as guaranteed income that have proven to help reduce economic disparities. Members of the Congressional Caucus, including New York Representative Yvette Clark of Brooklyn, have also introduced a resolution encouraging their colleagues to follow the blueprint from the BWB report. This is Lily Bolke with New York News Connection.
United States District Judge John S. Tyer vacated several Trump-era changes to the Endangered Species Act, or ESA, which had removed protections for hundreds of species. The Trump regulations had limited protections and allowed officials to consider economic costs when making decisions about saving a struggling species. Under that administration, species like the northern spotted owl and gray wolves lost protection. Nicholas Arrivo, managing attorney at the Humane Society of the United States, said, quote, "This decision is a huge win for wildlife because it eliminates several needless and illegal barriers that made it more difficult for imperiled species, especially those threatened by the long-term effects of climate change, like wolverines, to receive comprehensive ESA protections," end quote. A federal tax forcing companies to help clean up Superfund sites has been reinstated. Mike Moen has more on the story.
Starting this month, chemical companies will resume being taxed for cleanup of areas with a lot of leftover toxic waste, also known as Superfund sites. It follows a slowdown in getting sites removed from the federal list. On July 1st, the tax was reinstated after it was allowed to expire in the mid-1990s. The recent changes were authorized under the bipartisan infrastructure law signed by President Joe Biden. Emily Rogers with the Public Interest Research Group says for a quarter century, the program languished by leaning on taxpayers as opposed to having the industry foot the bill.
The funds that were used to clean up Superfund sites dropped precipitously, and with that drop, also the number of sites that were cleaned up each year dropped precipitously.
Annual completion of Superfund projects has fallen to single digits in recent years. Iowa has 11 sites on the national priorities list. Supporters say the tax will provide $14 billion over the next decade to accelerate this work. Industry groups lobbied against the move, and PIRG anticipates similar opposition amid efforts to reinstate a tax for petroleum companies. Beyond Iowa, Rogers says Superfund sites can be found all over the country, especially in marginalized communities. She says one in six Americans lives within 3 miles of these hazardous sites.
The waste at these sites can cause some really serious human health effects. So that's one reason we've been working so hard to get funding reinstated.
And under the growing threat of climate change, PIRG notes many of these sites are at greater risk of flooding, potentially spreading contamination into nearby communities. The program's funding is used whenever the party at fault for the pollution can't be located or lacks the money to pay for the cleanup. Mike Moen, Iowa News Service.
Legislative walkouts have become increasingly common in Oregon. Voters will now have an opportunity to change the state constitution this November in order to discourage them. An effort to prevent the tactic, often used by the state's Republican minority in recent years, has qualified for the general election ballot. The Secretary of State's office reviewed a petition and found it had 155,343 valid signatures, roughly 84% of those submitted, and more than the 149,360 necessary to qualify. Initiative Petition 14, nicknamed Legislative Accountability 1, bars legislators from seeking re-election if they have 10 or more unexcused absences in a given session. The proposal is intended to curtail the ability of the minority party to freeze legislative action by walking away from the Capitol. Under quorum rules set out in the state constitution, two-thirds of a legislative chamber's lawmakers must be present in order for the chamber to conduct business. Both parties have employed legislative walkouts to achieve their aims. Democrats left briefly in 2001 because of a political skirmish over redistricting.
Republicans left in 2019 and again in 2020 in order to block a bill that could have capped greenhouse gas emissions in the state. Governor Kate Brown responded by taking executive action instead. Oregon's three largest unions spent more than $1.5 million since last year to place the measure on the ballot, with most of that money going to petition circulators. The measure does rely heavily on the Speaker of the House and the Senate President, the two presiding officers who decide whether or not a lawmaker's absence is excused. Excused absences are fairly routine in Salem. They are not granted in cases where lawmakers are absent in order to block legislation. The measure's backers say that polling shows a broad majority of Oregon voters support the idea. Washington State looks to expand college access. Eric Tegetoff has more on the story.
The number of people with some higher education but no degree or other credential to show for it has increased in recent years, according to a new report. The number of Washingtonians with some college is especially stark. The National Student Clearinghouse Research Center finds about 1.1 million Washington State students without a credential. Michael Miotti, executive director of Washington Student Achievement Council, says this pool of adult students is larger than those coming out of high school, but often needs different support to finish higher education.
They need to have a program that they can complete within, say, up to a year and have it deliver some immediate value to them and perhaps their family in terms of employability or earnings power.
Washington State set a goal in 2013 to have at least 70% of people between ages 25 and 44 with a post-secondary degree by 2023, but is likely to miss that mark, especially in the wake of the pandemic's effect on enrollment. Miotti says paying for college is a big barrier for students, but he notes that Washington State is generous, with financial aid programs able to pay tuition and fees for about one-third of students in the state. He says many people don't know that aid can be used for multiple education priorities.
There's just a lot of public assumptions that financial aid is for academic programs. It's for being a psychology major and getting a degree, and they don't realize financial aid can cover getting your certificate as automobile service technician. Financial aid can help you in an apprenticeship program, which you get paid while you're learning.
Miotti says it's time to rethink pathways for adults. He's convinced that would be helpful for everyone, especially in Washington State, where many jobs require advanced skills.
We can't look at the world as if it's what you know at the age of 23, 24, what credentials you have at that age define the rest of your career. That might have been the way it was in the 50s and 60s, but that's the past, and the world's different now.
Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. Today, we interview the editor-in-chief of Street Roots about their new reporting on the frequency of short-notice homeless camp sweeps in Portland. At 6, it's Rhythm Nation with Peter Marks. At 8, it's Drinking from Puddles. Tonight's weather will be overcast with a low of 61. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 77. Today in history, in 1854, the first convention of the United States Republican Party was held. The quote of the day is from National Union Party member and 16th U.S. President Abraham Lincoln, who said, "The probability that we may fall in the struggle ought not to deter us from the support of a cause we believe to be just." Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to fight on, despite a number of recent political setbacks. Meanwhile, lawmakers met to plan ways to force him out, possibly within days. Two UK ministers resigned yesterday, including the health secretary. Several other officials followed suit, including the Minister for Children and Families. Their departures opened the floodgates for a movement against Johnson within his party that has been building against him for months. Johnson moved quickly to announce some replacements, indicating that he planned to try to steady the government and fight for his job. According to the Times of London, when an ally asked him on Tuesday evening whether he planned to resign, he replied negatively with an expletive. The latest British scandal involves accusations of sexual misconduct and excessive drinking by a conservative lawmaker. Johnson had backed the lawmaker, Chris Pincher.
Johnson has already survived multiple investigations, a criminal fine, and a recent no-confidence vote in his own party. All were related to parties held in Downing Street during coronavirus lockdowns. But it was the recent promotion of Pincher that apparently led to at least some of the resignations. Last week, Pincher resigned as the party's deputy chief whip after admitting to having been drunk at a private members' club in London where he allegedly groped two men. Johnson had been told about previous accusations against Pincher in 2019, though his office initially denied it. Sajid Javid, who decided to step down as health minister on Tuesday, told Parliament today that he was deeply concerned about how the next generation would view Johnson's Conservative Party. He said, quote, "I have concluded that the problem starts at the top, and that is not going to change. I do fear that the reset button can only work so many times. There are only so many times you can turn that machine on and off before you realize that something is fundamentally wrong," end quote. The statement crystallized the sentiment of many who have raised concerns about government leadership and support for Johnson from fellow conservatives appeared to be waning. A new United Nations report shows that as many as 828 million people, around one-tenth of the world's population, suffered from chronic malnourishment last year. That's an increase of 150 million since the world shut down due to COVID, and the worst appears yet to come. These numbers do not include 2022 statistics or the effects of the Russian invasion of Ukraine. David Beasley, executive director of the UN's World Food Program, said, quote, "The global price spikes in food, fuel, and fertilizers as a result of the crisis in Ukraine threaten to push countries around the world into famine. The result will be global destabilization, starvation, and mass migration on an unprecedented scale," end quote. A new study by the University of British Columbia shows fluctuating levels of spawning salmon threaten southern resident killer whales. The whales have not had enough food for several years, which could affect their already small numbers. Researchers looked at food requirements and availability of prey for northeastern Pacific southern resident killer whales. They feed on Chinook salmon, but the number of Chinook has decreased over recent decades, despite fishing regulations aimed at bolstering their numbers. Animals high on the food chain, like killer whales, end up without adequate prey. Lack of food intake for killer whales has led to lower birth rates and higher death rates. The current study did show a slightly higher birth rate in years where the killer whales met their dietary needs. About 75 of the southern resident killer whales reside between California and British Columbia. Native American leaders meet to discuss the United States Supreme Court ruling giving states and the federal government co-jurisdiction over crimes on tribal lands. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The United States Supreme Court recently issued an opinion giving states concurrent jurisdiction with the federal government over major crimes in Indian Country. This week, tribal leaders are holding a virtual roundtable to determine how to move forward. An attorney with the Native American Rights Fund says the opinion impacts tribes across the country. Victoria Wicks reports.
2 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court issued its McGirt ruling that restored historical reservation boundaries in Oklahoma. As a result, almost half of that state, including Tulsa, is now Indian Country. Before that decision came out, the state of Oklahoma tried and convicted Victor Castro Huerta for child neglect. After the McGirt ruling, Castro Huerta appealed his conviction, saying the state did not have jurisdiction because the crime occurred in Tulsa on tribal land and the young victim is Cherokee. The Supreme Court disagreed and found that the state has concurrent jurisdiction with the feds over a non-Indian, even under these circumstances. The situation in Oklahoma is extremely unusual, with a large and sudden increase in tribal land mass and on-reservation population. Oklahoma argued that federal prosecutors have been overwhelmed with felony cases, and so the state needs to step in. But NARF attorney Melody McCoy says the recent opinion affects more states than Oklahoma, which was joined by Texas as an amicus.
There's 35 states around the United States that have federally recognized tribes within their borders. I'm not convinced that every single state has the same level of and type of interest that Oklahoma and Texas have.
She says there are 574 federally recognized tribes of varying sizes and relationships with states, and it will fall to their leaders to find ways to protect tribal sovereignty and keep their citizens safe. For National Native News, I'm Victoria Wicks in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Cherokee Nation citizen Dwight Birdwell received the Medal of Honor Tuesday for his service during the Vietnam War. President Joe Biden awarded the 74-year-old with the military's highest honor during a ceremony at the White House.
A member of the Cherokee Nation, Birdwell credits the Cherokee veterans who came before him and encouraged him to serve when he called. And I might note, Native American communities, a larger percentage, serve in the United States Armed Forces at a higher percentage rate than any other cohort in America. After leaving the Army, Birdwell continued to build a legacy of service in his community in Oklahoma.
Specialist 5 Birdwell's Army troop was involved in an attack in Saigon in 1968. His tank commander became incapacitated and many of the unit's vehicles were disabled or destroyed. Birdwell moved the tank commander to safety. He was wounded when he took command and continued fighting, remained on the battlefield after running out of ammunition, and aided in evacuating the wounded. Birdwell says receiving the recognition is a great honor. Birdwell served on the Cherokee Nation's highest court for more than a decade and continues to practice law. He was one of 4 soldiers honored Tuesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
KBOO news poet Dan Raphael says holidays are getting confusing.
This 4th of July, in several American cities, when you heard a pop, you had to ask yourself, is that a firecracker or a gun? Welcome to Codependence Day, where the hurting and hateful are enabled by the Supreme Court, the Republican power junkies, and the gun industry. Maybe next year, Memorial Day will honor those shot to death by other Americans, as well as those who died in one of our never-ending wars. This Labor Day, we should remember that democracy, peace, and community require working together, working hard. Maybe come Thanksgiving, we can be grateful we still have Democrat majorities in the Congress and Senate. All I want for Christmas, though it would be great if it came early, is a larger Supreme Court and the repeal of the filibuster. Maybe throw in a worldwide commitment to save our planet. Then 2023 will have the potential to truly be a new year.